Paul is actually saying, my former way of living within Judaism, I've changed to another way of living within Judaism. The new perspective, this view of an ethnocentric Judaism that's trying to push itself onto non-Jews, is actually just sort of a reinscription of, actually Christian theology, that if you're out, you're damned, so you have to get in. And Jews didn't generally think about non-Jews that way, as though you're out, you're not us, therefore you're damned. You're just not the elect. But the opposite of elect doesn't mean damned, it's just non-elect. And I think this is what Paul's playing with. I think he thinks Pnuma is material, it's actual stuff, but it's the best, absolute best stuff out there.
Today, I am joined by Dr. Matthew Thiessen. Dr. Thiessen, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I've been looking forward to this conversation. We're going to be talking about your recent book, A Jewish Paul, The Messiah's Herald to the Gentiles, which I have here and people can check out. I'll have a link to it down below. But it's a really exciting book that, and I know you talk in the introduction, the label here is kind of, maybe suboptimal of Paul within Judaism, but we'll work with that for now. And in the last few decades, we've seen kind of an explosion of scholarly work around Paul. Some people that watch my channel that might be familiar with what's called the New Perspective on Paul, people like E.P. Sanders or James Dunn or N.T. Wright. And then they might be familiar with, they might think it's like the Standard, or maybe they'd call it the Lutheran Perspective, the Old Perspective. But I'm guessing less of them are familiar with this idea of Paul within Judaism or the radical perspective on Paul. So just to start and kind of situate this conversation, could you give us some background on what this is, this perspective, and maybe where it comes from?
So it's hard to know how far back to go. But let me just like briefly talk about sort of the more popular takes to situate this. For the most part, Pauline studies has been, academic scholarship has been dictated by what has often been referred to as the Lutheran reading of Paul. And so that's in part because Paul is so important historically to Protestantism. And this reading of Paul is that Paul has a particular problem with Judaism. The problem is that Judaism is a religion of legalism or works righteousness. Jews thought they had to earn God's favor, worked really hard to, and either convinced themselves that they had, which was arrogant and presumptuous, or realized that they hadn't, and just led to a lot of self-despair. And so Paul comes along with this gospel of freedom and grace, as opposed to having to work to earn your faith, to earn your salvation. And it was Ed Sanders, who you mentioned, E.P. Sanders, who in 1977 wrote a book showing just how thoroughly ancient Jews believed that God was gracious and didn't think that they had to sort of work to earn their salvation, but that they were elected as a divine action and gift for them. And so that couldn't possibly be Paul's problem with Judaism. And so it's out of that that the new perspective arose. It's not quite as though E.P. Sanders was new perspective himself, but it gives rise to this new view that Dunn and Wright and others put forward, that Paul's problem isn't that Judaism is a religion of works righteousness. It's got to be a different problem. The problem is that Jews are ethnocentric and they have national pride, that they're better than the nations, and that for the nations to be saved, or the Gentiles to be saved, they have to become Jews. And so in this new perspective, Paul pushes back against this ethnocentrism of a gospel of universalism and inclusion. And so in N.T. Wright's famous words, Paul's gospel was a gospel of grace, not race. So there are those sort of two major perspectives that probably many people have heard of. And the Paul within Judaism group, which has sort of been forming over the last 10, 15 years, suggests there's a whole paradigm problem with both of those. They share a very similar structure, and the problem is that Paul thinks there's something wrong, inherently wrong, with Judaism, that his gospel, that Christianity, save people from. And the Paul within Judaism school, in many different ways, tries to argue that Paul never thinks about Judaism as the problem, and never thinks of leaving Judaism for something new called Christianity. And we all answer exactly what that looks like in different ways. But the whole point is it's not Paul against Judaism or Paul outside of Judaism. It's Paul within Judaism, viewing himself in his movement, in his gospel as, within Judaism and in keeping with the law and Israel's scriptures.
That's really helpful. And I wonder, for those who are new to this, this might sound very radical, if you will, as some term, the perspective. You mentioned that with the new perspective on Paul, there is, I'll call it a watershed, if you will, moment where E.P. Sanders says, hey guys, like, by the way, you know, ancient Judaism around the first century, it was full of grace. Like the problem you thought Paul was trying to solve, it wasn't that one. So whatever it was, it's got to be something different. And that led to subsequent theories. Has there been something similar that you would point people to, or maybe for you in your own experience, for seeing Paul within Judaism, of this insight, kind of like Judaism is a religion of grace, but maybe something different, that led you or others to say, wait, like, it's not the grace race thing either. It's something different. We need a third perspective.
Yeah, so way back when I was working on my dissertation, I was working on the topic of circumcision in ancient Judaism. And, you know, it quickly became clear to me that even the idea of conversion, that Gentiles converting to Judaism, is a form of inclusion. It's openness to the possibility that you can enter into this movement. And so, there's maybe an ethnocentric component to that. You've got to do the things that we do. But here is something on offer in the first century that one could equally call inclusion. The reality is, though, many, and maybe most ancient Jews weren't sitting around thinking about non-Jews converting to Judaism. And almost no one was thinking about, let's go out and missionize Gentiles and turn them into Jews. It's a very rarely, if ever, attested phenomenon. I think it's attested a few times, but it's so few, it's pretty remarkable. And so part of it for me was coming to the realization that the new perspective, this view of an ethnocentric Judaism that's trying to push itself onto non-Jews, is actually just sort of a reinscription of, actually Christian theology, that if you're out, you're damned, so you have to get in. And Jews didn't generally think about non-Jews that way, as though you're out, you're not us, therefore you're damned. You're just not the elect. But the opposite of elect doesn't mean damned, it's just non-elect. Maybe some of those are damned, but there may be others who are saved, and they're saved not as Jews or as Israel, but as Gentiles, and that God extends his grace even beyond the confines of ethnic Israel to non-Jews. So then that made me rethink, well, wait a minute. Ancient Judaism is just very diverse in what they think about Gentiles, and we need to sort of resituate Paul within that diversity and not just think of Judaism as like pre-Christianity or Christianity light or some other form of Christianity.
That's really helpful, and it's such a tempting thing to do, right? Not just in this case, but in any encounter with historical text, is kind of read our current understanding of things back into it. So that's a just helpful kind of hermeneutical caution, I think, for people as they're thinking about this. And, you know, speaking of hermeneutics, which is kind of what we're doing when we're interpreting Paul, at least in part, right? It turns out that apparently Paul's been hard to understand on this topic for since he was around. And I found it really interesting that one of the places you take us to in your book is in Acts 21, where we see in Paul's lifetime, people were confused about his relationship to Judaism and what he was and was not teaching. And you write the following: modern readers of Paul are left with a choice. Side with common and traditional views of Paul against Luke, or side with Luke against traditional accounts of Paul. And that's kind of close quotes. Nice kind of like short, succinct thing there. But can you talk us about the importance of this passage and why it's so critical to understanding how Paul relates to Judaism, such that we could put it in a way of like, you're either with Luke or you're with Luther, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a bit cheeky because I'm trying to push especially Christian readers. Not all of my readers are, not all readers of Paul are Christian, but especially those who are Christian, to look at a canonical depiction of Paul and think about what that means for their own depictions or their own understandings of Paul. And that's Acts 21, where the Jerusalem leaders, the leaders of the Jerusalem, what we would call church or the Jesus movement, talk to Paul and they're convinced he's observant of the law. And what they're convinced about is there's been a deep misunderstanding. And they're convinced that what Paul actually teaches is Gentiles not to observe the Jewish law, or at least the parts of the Jewish law that don't relate to them, but that he's never said anything like that. Stop keeping the law, don't get circumcised, to Jewish believers in Jesus. And so there's like an ethnic component, an ethnic specificity to what Paul says. And that's something that's been lost with both the new perspective and the Lutheran perspective. And so when Paul does exactly what the Jerusalem leaders want him to do, it goes against anything that the Lutheran or new perspective readings of Paul should expect. And so it really is a matter of like, is, you know, historians are right, can rightly ask, is Luke accurate here? Or is he making this up? And historians debate that. Does this actually go against what the historical Paul actually taught, so to speak? And that's an important historical question, but sort of as a canonical or theological question, it's, we get to Paul only, first through Acts. And Acts depicts Paul repeatedly, actually, through Acts of the Apostles, and even at the end of Acts, as someone who is committed to the law of Israel, never breaking it, and repeatedly saying that. And so how do Christian readers who have this as part of their canon deal with that? Do they disagree with that, which is kind of remarkable, and thus side with Paul's opponents in Acts? Or do they have to then go back to Paul's letters and say, maybe we've just been reading them wrong. Maybe we need to read them differently. And I think Acts is trying to get us to read Paul and think about Paul differently.
Yeah, and I think part of that reading him differently seems to be seeing this idea of Paul the observant Jew that we find in Acts 21 as something that continues throughout his letters, which brings us to a really, maybe not thorny question, but an important question of, did Paul ever convert, and using kind of anachronistic language there, I suppose, in a way, but did he ever convert to Christianity? And I can think of people who are maybe preparing objections, thinking of things like, my former life in Judaism is one that often will come to mind here. And so if he didn't convert, as most people might assume that he did, how would we, or I guess, how can we begin to read this differently and see that maybe what people assumed happened there isn't actually what happened?
Yeah. Yeah. So that those verses, which you cited or alluded to from Galatians 1, there are multiple ways one can read that. And one is his former life in Judaism, and he's now abandoned his life in Judaism. I think it's more likely, and I'm not alone here, that Paul is actually saying, my former way of living within Judaism, I've changed to another way of living within Judaism. Kind of as though, so I guess this is one of those questions. Does someone convert when they convert from being a Baptist to being an Episcopalian, or Methodist to Mennonite or something? Do we use that language? Sometimes we do. I've heard one person in my lifetime talk about converting to Methodism, and I actually thought it was just really jarring and odd, because they were, you know, just broadly evangelical before that. So, you know, I think part of it's like, what do we consider conversion? But the reality is, what does Paul have to convert to? Did Luther convert to Lutheranism? Not really. And it's even more so, I think, with Paul. He doesn't have, or at least we don't know if he has the category of Christianity. It's first attested in Acts of the Apostles. And when exactly that's written is a matter of massive scholarly debate. So it's highly unlikely Paul had the language of Christian or Christianity available and as a category that he's now, I'm now in this. And if he did have the category, he doesn't ever use it. And that's, in its own way quite telling, I think, because that would suggest he doesn't like the category. I'm going to, you know, avoid that terminology because I think it's problematic for some reason. So either way, I think it's, you know, historically more sensitive to think about Paul as whatever he's doing. And he is changing some of his ways. He's obviously changing some of his thinking. He still considers himself to be within what we would call Judaism. He still, you know, he says, I'm a Jew repeatedly. And so that's how he identifies. He doesn't think of himself as non-Jewish, which is what we mean when we say Christian or Christianity.
That brings us to our sponsor for today's video, which is Life Atlas. Life Atlas is a vision and goal setting program designed to help you simplify habits and goal setting so that you can live the life that you were created for. You might have heard of another one of their products, Monk Manual, which I use every day. It's a product that has helped me be more present, set better goals, better habits. But Life Atlas, it's a product that builds on that. Not only does it have a beautiful journal and a beautiful physical product.
Sorry, future Austin had to butt in here and say that I absolutely undersold this. The physical product, the journal itself is absolutely incredible. Like, I'm so stoked to use this. Let me show you in just 1 second.
All right, so here it is. Peep the icons in the background. You open it up and you've got all these different dividers, which just makes my heart so happy. Your life vision, inventory, year goals. You got your months divided up into, I guess that's quarters there. And then you have opportunities to reflect at the back. I mean, this thing is absolutely incredible. It's really going to help you just organize what it is that you want to do in this next year and make it happen. And you're going
to
love it.
That's a bit better. Check it out. Back to the rest of this ad.
But it's also a coaching program where you can go through a curriculum that helps you understand what life is about and how to set the goals that you want and actually achieve them. Many of us set New Year's resolutions and we have these great goals, but no plan, no follow through. And well, you've, I'm sure, heard me talk that habits are so powerful and that what we really need to change our lives is set up better habits. That's what this program does. But it's not just kind of like some like secular, like how to be a better you program. It's actually from a friend of mine who is a practicing Catholic. And it actually started from the story of St. Philip Neri and questioning a young man about what he wanted out of his life. And so Stephen, the founder of it, is going to be on the channel soon. He developed this program to help you set better goals, take control of your life, and live a more meaningful life. And so if you want to check that out, you can use the link down below and use the promo code Gospel Simplicity for $100 off this program. It's an incredible deal. It's a year-long program, and I really think it could be the difference between you setting goals that fall by February and actually achieving goals that set you on a trajectory for a different life. So I hope you enjoy it. Yeah, you have this wonderful little diagram early on in the book where we often think I think you have it as like Jew Christian and then Jew Gentile, of which Christian could fall in multiple categories there. If I have that right, is that correct? Kind of.
Yeah. It's when we hear the word Jew or Christian, or when we hear the word Christian, we think of it's something mutually exclusive from Jewishness, right? And there are, and maybe we'll think about it from time to time. There are Messianic Jews today who are believers in Jesus, yet also, you know, really stress their Jewish identity. But that mutual exclusion, if we try to map that onto Paul, I think we really get into some real anachronistic thinking. And so that's why I really stress avoiding, when talking about Paul, any of that language of Christianity, even church, which, you know, is a translation one can give of the Greek. But of course, it, again, and to our ears implies something distinct from Judaism. Church is something that has a steeple, stained glass windows, maybe some pews, and it's distinct from like a synagogue or a mosque. And the Greek term ekklesia, which church translates, just means a gathering. It's a non-specific gathering. And so when we add too much specificity to it, again, we might lead ourselves into trouble conceptualizing Paul and his world.
I really enjoyed the amount of re-languaging in a way that you did in your book, because it forces us to confront our own assumptions, because all of these words, they don't just have like their dictionary definition to us, but they carry all of this meaningful baggage. And I don't mean that in necessarily a bad way, but these words are laden with meaning for us. And when we shift the words we're using, we begin to see things in a different light. And one of the things that I think is important that you mentioned was that, you know, what we don't see Paul doing is converting to this thing called Christianity, but it might be a kind of different type of Judaism or a different flavor of it. And you point out repeatedly in the book that first century Judaism isn't this like univocal thing. It's not monolithic. It's not just one type. Could you expand on that a little bit for people? Because I think so often, Paul doesn't exactly help us with this, right? When and scripture in general, when you have Jew, Gentile, just these two huge categories as though they're one and one. But could you explain a little for the audience the idea that there's kind of Judaism's plural at this time?
Yeah, I think the easiest way for modern readers to think about it is, think about your own faith, whether it's Christianity or something else, or your own denomination, or your nationality. And then think about the way, whenever you hear sort of stereotypes about any of those, Christianity is Republican. Well, that's not actually true. Types of Christianity are certainly more Republican focused than other forms of Christianity. Of course, here I'm talking American Christianity, but that's, as soon as you hear Christianity believes this or does this, you already know if you're a Christian, that's not true. Because we all know Christians disagree over everything. Christians baptize infants. We know that's not true. Some Christians do, some don't. And some don't baptize at all. And so that same the same care we want people to use when talking about us, our religious traditions, our nationality, our identities of whatever sort, we need to have that same caution and accuracy around others, modern and in antiquity. And so, ancient Jews held to a whole variety of different beliefs and did different things. And so to say Jews, anytime you hear sort of the language of Jews believe this or Jews did that, a yellow caution flag at least should come up, if not a red one, to say, hold on a minute, that's probably wrong. Be careful here. It's probably more complicated than that. And so if it's, the thing is, and I guess this is really the point, if we say Judaism is X, Y, or Z, or Z, then it becomes really easy, I think, to quickly say, oh, Paul's not Jewish because he doesn't do maybe this or that, or believe quite that. But you could do that with any ancient Jew then. Any ancient Jewish text we have is going to disagree at some point or other with one's caricature of this is Judaism. And so that's the sort of caution I think we need to apply when we talk about Judaism.
I appreciate that. And it's one of those things that seems intuitive in some ways when we put it into modern categories. Like you wouldn't say all this group, well, hopefully you wouldn't say all of the people in this group believe one thing, but somehow we don't always give that same charity to previous groups. We, in history generally, we like to make these really neat and tidy categories, but they don't often hold water. Yeah. I want to direct us towards what I see as a really important piece of this conversation. And you mentioned earlier that when you're working on your dissertation, you were doing a lot on circumcision. And I think it's a good place to go in understanding what Paul's doing here. And so we see a lot of conversation in Paul about this idea of circumcision. He seems to be rather vehemently against those who are saying that the Gentiles should be circumcised, especially in Galatians, but elsewhere. So why is it for Paul that Gentiles shouldn't be circumcised? And how does this kind of give us insight into how he's thinking about the law and its relationship to maybe non-Jewish believers in Jesus? Big question, couple parts there.
I think there are a variety of reasons Paul is very anti-circumcision when it comes to Gentiles. And so again, there's that ethnic specificity. It's not universally against circumcision, but against Gentile circumcision. One, Paul doesn't think circumcision is a law that God gave to non-Jews. Genesis 17, Leviticus 12 are the two places where we get these commands, and they're really for Abraham and his sons. And yeah, Ishmael gets circumcised, but guess what? He's not actually in the covenant. And so when Gentiles get circumcised, they're not actually keeping the law. It doesn't have the covenantal value that makes it a right worth doing. And so especially in like Galatians 4, 3 and 4, we get this language of Abrahamic sonship. And for Paul, you know, some of these Gentiles think they're doing the law and it's making them Abrahamic children. And Paul says, you're not even listening properly to the law. You're not going to become Abrahamic sons, or at least inheriting Abrahamic sons. It doesn't give you what you want. And so, you know, in the book, I talk about it as an effort to do plastic surgery or cosmetic surgery in order to look like Abraham, but it doesn't actually connect you to Abraham. It's this fake thing, surface thing. And that's one of Paul's condemnations of it. The other thing, and this is where we get into Paul's very clear works versus faith when it comes to righteousness. And this is, I think, ultimately like what's most heavy sort of theologically for Paul. The Gentiles have already received the Messiah and the Messiah's spirit. By adding law to that, they're basically saying that Messiah and the Messiah's spirit was insufficient to get us what we needed. And for Paul, that is very upsetting. So he is adamantly against doing that when you're a Gentile. For Jews, it's a different story. They have the law. They're circumcised. By adding Christ to that, they're ultimately saying this is sort of the culmination of the law. We're adding Christ to the law. And so there's a different sort of valence value given when it's Gentiles versus Jews in circumcision.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that I'd love to get into there, and I imagine we will. You mentioned the Spirit, which I thought was one of the most interesting parts of the book. I'm going to put a pin in that for now. We're going to get to that in a second. But there's this question of the law for the Gentiles. And I think for a lot of people, when they're trying to understand Paul, a lot of it comes down to, okay, but how do believers of Jesus who are not Jewish, the Gentile believers, how do they relate to the Jewish law? And it's perplexing to them. They want to, you know, I think many of them are trying to be faithful to what they see, you know, this is scripture for us, and how, what am I supposed to do? There's all these commandments. How do I relate to that? And they look to Paul for help. So I think there's two questions people often run up against. Like, is the law deficient in some way? Which we've touched on a little. And then the second part is, what parts as non-Jews should we keep? So could we wade into that a bit?
Yeah, let me flip those questions around and start with the one you ended on.
Yeah.
Gentiles in the law. So I will say, first of all, Paul is absolutely not alone here. The Hebrew Bible itself makes it clear, these are laws for you, these are laws for Israel. Say to the sons of Israel, blah, 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 blah. And so there's already that statement there. So by going and saying, oh, so non-Jews should do this too, there's actually an extrapolation happening there, an interpretive extrapolation. It may be right, it may be wrong, but it is an extrapolation. So that's the first thing. Other ancient Jewish authors, both before Paul, like for instance in the Book of Jubilees, and after Paul, like in rabbinic literature, frequently stress these are laws for Israel. They're not for everyone. Most of the laws of the Pentateuch are for Israel, not for everyone. One of the most important church fathers, Origen, makes this point repeatedly in his commentary on Galatians, commentary on Romans. So Paul's not alone in this. But then Jews were asking, okay, so what if this does apply to non-Jews? And, you know, many scholars, and I'm broadly in this camp, point to what we see, especially in later rabbinic literature, but we might see hints of it earlier. We definitely see some hints of it in Acts, for instance, that there are these broad sort of moral principles that are for all of humanity, and they show up after the flood in Genesis 9, the Noahide laws that really revolve around murder and sexual immorality and theft and consumption of blood of any animal is for all humanity, according to most ancient Jews. And that these are these sort of broad principles. And idolatry. You shouldn't worship the wrong god, and you shouldn't worship images of those gods, but you should worship the one supreme god. So some scholars talk about the Jews believe that Gentiles needed to be ethical monotheists. And that's broadly how I view myself and how I view, I think, Paul. And so, you know, there are books on this. So there's sort of easing into the poll or the question you were asking about what stuff applies to Gentiles. Most of the what has often been referred to as the ritual or ceremonial aspects of the law don't. I just like to think of them as these are the things that sort of distinguish Israel from others. And so that's what doesn't get applied to Gentiles. Your first question, and now I've forgotten it. This is awful.
Is the law deficient?
Thank you. Yes. I would never use the word deficient. Because there's a negative valence to that. So I guess it's something like this. We have a minivan for our family. Were I to try to drive across Lake Erie, which is not too far from here, one of the Great Lakes, in my van, it truly would be deficient, or insufficient is probably a better way to put it, insufficient to get across Lake Erie because it would sink. But that's because it's not designed for that. And so it's not, if you're going to use the word deficiency, it's deficiency by design. It has a specific role, and for its role, it's sufficient. But if you use it for more than what it's intended for, you're going to run into trouble. And when it gets to Paul, A, you're trying to apply the law to Gentiles, and that's not what it was designed for. You need to use it according to the rules. And if you're trying to get it to make dead Gentiles alive and alive to God, that's not what it's designed for. The law can't make someone alive, someone dead alive. And so it has built-in limitations, divinely limited uses. And to go beyond that is when you start getting into trouble, because it can do certain things.
I think the popular understanding, and maybe broadly kind of not Lutheran churches, but people following that, that you might hear in like a sermon would be something like the law was, you know, to put it maybe a bit of a caricature, like to show us how bad we are, or the law was to show us that we really need a savior, or any number of these kind of common phrases around that.
Yep.
From your perspective, are those right? A, and then if not, what maybe are they missing, or kind of some nuance that's yeah. not applied correctly there?
Yeah, I mean, it's I'm not going to deny that there's that having a set of rules or laws can result in a greater self-awareness of one's limitations. But do I think that was like the sort of intention or purpose of the law? No, not really. And part of my response to that would be, at least according to the literature we see, and I imagine, practically speaking, Israel has these sets of laws and rules, and some are around morality, as ancient Israelites and ancient Jews thought about it. It's not surprising, it wouldn't be surprising to me that the majority of Jews were seeking to keep those rules as well as they could. And in as much as they were doing that, as opposed to non-Jews, they may have very different sort of moral qualms that may look very different, especially around sexuality or whatever, then it's going to look very much like the law was a source of knowledge and an instrument to help guide people in paths of righteousness. And so if you're doing it and you're looking better than your Gentile neighbors, I don't know that you're going to come away with some like deep sense of, wow, I'm so awfully sinful. You might be aware that you're still sinning. You're not living up to it, but you have a whole temple system that is actually designed around the idea that you're imperfect and you're going to fail. And God is graciously extending God's, you know, means to restoration and forgiveness via this, this temple system. So I guess I don't fully see that Lutheran-esque use of the law at play in Paul.
I think one of the things that when I first came across this perspective that was a major shift for me was the difference in how a faithful ancient Jew might have interiorized that sense of the law, that like you could be justified. You're not just having this like really internal wrestling that we might see in Luther of this like deep angst over it. And that there was grace there, that it really does kind of shift how you think about it. And I think how you go back and read the Old Testament, at least it did for me. There's one other important kind of paradigm shift I want to get to before we get to the spirit or the pneuma. But one of those things, it has to do with Paul's audience, and this might seem a little out of left field for people, but when I first came across the Paul within Judaism perspective, and something that I think has held true, it seemed to hold true in your book, across other works, is the importance of getting right who Paul is talking to, because it colors how we understand what he's saying about the law. For instance, if he's saying like, hey, like the law's not going to materially help you in, you know, X, Y, or Z way. If he's saying that to a Jew, that seems to be a stronger critique of the law than saying that to someone who, hey, this law wasn't designed for you, so therefore it's not going to help you in the way you want it to. So can we just touch on it briefly, the importance of, is Paul talking to mixed audiences in his letters, or is he writing specifically to a Gentile audience, and maybe what does that do for us?
So I would say, it's really important to acknowledge at the end of the day, we don't know who's reading these things initially. We know a letter goes to Rome, or a letter goes to Galatia, but we don't know who's there on the ground, what flesh and blood humans and who they are, Jews or Gentiles. But Paul repeatedly stresses through all of his letter that he is the apostle, not just the apostle, but he has a specific mission to the Gentiles. And so already in some ways, it looks like Paul is constraining or acknowledging the limitations around where his authority, his divinely given authority lies, and it's to non-Jews. And you see this really clearly in Romans, where there are bookends in Romans 1 and Romans 15. And that's where most people think there's a Jewish and non-Jewish audience at play. But as you read through the letter carefully, what becomes really quite clear is that Paul is writing to non, in his mind, so the implied reader or the intended reader is a non-Jew. And so whatever he says about the law applies specifically to non-Jews. There may be Jews in the audience overhearing it, but he's already given enough hints that this is actually specifically for non-Jews. So I think that's really important. And this goes back to an earlier question about Acts. Again, it really fits nicely with Acts 21, where the Jerusalem leaders say, very specifically, we know you're not saying this to Jews, but now here are the parts of the law that apply to non-Jews, because most of the law doesn't. And so there's this nice specific ethnic component to Paul's message, even in Acts 21. And as soon as we get that wrong, that's when we start getting into like larger misunderstandings of what Paul's up to, and misunderstandings that he's like critiquing the law, critiquing Judaism specifically, when it's the improper use of the law.
Yeah, and that misunderstanding specifically, not just of the law, but of Judaism, has led to lots and lots of strife, I think, historically, as we look at Christian-Jewish relationships, and one only would have to read, say, Chrysostom or Luther to get a little bit of a taste of what that can look like at its worst at times. I want to shift here to talk about the spirit, the pneuma, however people like to pronounce their Greek here. So I found it really interesting, as I said multiple times, but essentially what it seems like we get to is this question of, okay, so for Paul, how do the Gentiles enter into the promises of God? How do they become part of the family of Abraham? And one of the obvious answers would have seemed to be, you get circumcised and you follow the law, to which Paul says, by no means, if we shall. He's not a fan of that option. But it it leaves a question of how is it that this happens, that there's this one family united under these promises, etc. For you in your book, one of the concepts that seems to do a lot of heavy lifting is the spirit and the spirit of the Messiah. Can you talk to us about how this idea of the spirit, which people might have as a, you know, a theological concept, but they might not connect it to this idea of Jew-Gentile right. relationships and how Gentiles are saved. So I'd love to touch on that here a bit.
Yeah, so early on in Romans 3, Paul talks about it's those of faith who are the sons of Abraham. And so sort of, you know, 2,000 years broadly of Christian theology have almost unanimously stressed faith makes you a child of Abraham. And that's not wrong, but I think Paul's actually doing a little bit more with it. And it's faith that is really closely intertwined. We don't need to get necessarily into debates about who's first here, and it might not be either. But faith and the spirit are closely intertwined, reception of the spirit, or pneuma. And so Paul, through Galatians 3 and 4 especially, stresses that it's, well, whose pneuma is this? It's the pneuma of the Messiah, who is A, the son and seed of Abraham, and B, God's son. And so if you are infused with the pneuma, the spirit of the Messiah, you are taking on his identity. And so what's really central to Paul's thinking, and it was Albert Schweitzer who really stressed this well over, 150 years ago, roughly, who stressed that what's central to Paul's thinking is being in Christ, not justification by faith, not anything else, but in Christ. And if you do a search and you look at in Christ language, it's just, you know, almost everywhere in Paul's letters. And it's this idea of being in the Messiah that is really important. And I think this is what the pneuma gets you. You are both immersed or infused with pneuma, the Messiah's pneuma, and you are enveloped in it. So you put on Christ, as Paul puts it in at the ends of towards the end of Galatians 3. And so your whole identity has now been become connected to and infused with the Messiah's identity. So who the Messiah is who you are. The Messiah is who the Messiah is by nature. You are who the Messiah is by adoption or by infusion with the Spirit. And so if Christ is related to Abraham and is Abraham's seed, anybody who's in Christ is also Abraham's seed. So I talk about it as, it's an analogy, but I talk about it as sort of the gene therapy of getting the Spirit. It's now giving you the Messiah's DNA, so to speak. And now you're connected to Abraham and to Abrahamic promises, even if you're a Gentile.
It's really, really interesting. And the mechanism for that, as you said, whether faith, spirit first, like they're deeply intertwined. But what was fascinating to me about reading this is I came across in college, the idea of union with Christ, got really interested in that as a theological topic, had some great professors who taught on that. But even within that, I mean, I think there's different ways people read these in Christ. Some, you just miss it, like you never notice that it's everywhere. Then for me, I started noticing it. I think some people could then say like, oh, that's a nice metaphor, or this is a nice kind of like theological concept of, you know, somehow vaguely we're united to Christ, whether that's through like the incarnation or however we want to take that in kind of a theological way. But you take this in a slightly different way, at least in my reading of you, and that's that there's actually like a spatiality here that's really important, and kind of a tangibility to this in Christness and how the Spirit's at play here. Would you introduce the listeners or viewers to that, because I think it might be new to them, but it makes an interesting case for what Paul's doing with his language.
It's so easy to sort of turn this into a metaphor or analogy or spiritualize it, which is funny because you're spiritualizing spirit. And I think the more we think that's what Paul's up to, the further we're getting away from Paul. And so part of it is, based on ancient Stoic science, which was, you know, not the only science of Paul's day, but it was a very popular science in Paul's day. in which pretty much everything, almost everything, was material, including Pneuma. And Pneuma most of all, in some ways. It's sort of like the best type of matter. And so I think this differs a lot from sort of classical, from classical Christian theology, which is more indebted to sort of Platonic modes of thought, in that matter is always considered bad. Because matter is subject to decay and change and everything else. And so therefore, if that's the way, if that's what matter is, you sure don't want God being that. And so you don't want God's spirit being that. If your definition of Pneuma is that this is the best type of matter, and it's actually not subject to decay, incorruptibility, and change, and death, but it is immortal, perfect, heavenly, so on and so forth, you get the same sort of results as Platonic thinking around non-materiality, except you have it in one particular type of matter, Pneuma. And I think this is what Paul's playing with. I think he thinks Pneuma is material. It's actual stuff, but it's the best, absolute best stuff out there. And everything else compared to it is garbage. And so there's a hierarchy of sort of being, and at the very top is Pneuma. And so it's the Messiah's Pneuma one gets, which forges an indelible, incorruptible, unchangeable, bond between Abraham and the Messiah and believers. And it's that which is going to get them ultimately the resurrection, when everything that's subject to decay, decays, over time and at the end of the ages. And so that's what Paul's, I think, playing with, when he talks about Pneuma.
This might be kind of reading slightly later categories back into Paul with this question, but you mentioned kind of like a hierarchy of being and the best type of matter and how this might clash with some classical Christian theism. I think something that people also might be thinking of, like, what does this do with kind of Trinitarian theology as well? Yeah. And I guess, so within that question, there's that. And also for Paul, do we have any indication? So the spirit is this... Yeah. Material type of thing. Would he apply that to God proper, if you will, as well? Like, if that's the best type of matter, or does he just not give us enough to go on? So there's kind of a Trinitarian question within a question there. Yep.
So this, for the Stoics, it's God is Pneuma, and God is everywhere. And God infuses everything. So it's panentheism. I don't think it's quite pantheism. It's panentheism. God is in everything. And that's, God is sort of the soul of the cosmos. And it's a material soul. It's what keeps it together and keeps it alive, in functioning. And, I'm pretty convinced that this is sort of how Paul, this is essentially how Paul views God as well. And some other ancient Jews would have viewed God as well. God is what, God is the soul or breath of the cosmos. And to remove God from anything is for it to die right away. Which is a depiction in Genesis 2 with humans. But you hear it in other things too about all life ending if God's spirit is removed. So I think that's what's at play. It's a text like Romans 8, the opening of Rome, really sort of Romans 8, 5 through 7 or 8, where you get, it's really dense, and it's, you hear about the Spirit, you hear about the Spirit of Christ, you hear about the Spirit of the one who raised Christ, and you sit there and you think to yourself, well, wait a minute, how many different spirits are at play here? Or is this one and the same Spirit? And I don't think Paul has all his sort of theological T's crossed and I's dotted. But it sure seems like it's easy to take a text like that and say, okay, this is where we have this dense collocation of God, the Father, God the Spirit, and then Jesus the Son. And they're all in some ways distinct and yet identified with one another. And so I think it's texts like that later Christians go on to say, okay, there is one God. but we have this kind of stuff in Paul. So then we have to come up with a Trinitarian formulation to make sense of these potentially disparate or contradictory, or at least texts which may be in some, you know, might feel like they're in tension. This is the way to resolve those tensions. And so I think you see something like, this is what Kavin Rowe at Duke has called the sort of Trinitarian pressure points of certain texts. And I think Romans 8 is a great example of that.
Thank you for that. That's helpful and really interesting stuff, I think, for people to go away from this episode and think about. One of the last questions I want to ask here before we get into the kind of final four questions, and thank you again so much for your time. This has been wonderful. Is one, maybe, if not an objection, maybe a concern that might come up from some of my audience. And I think you somewhat address it, and it's like the first or second chapter where you say, is this a long lost or kind of like a new interpretation? But I think some people might be saying, like, if not just his view of the Spirit, but of the law of Jew-Gentile relationships in general, look like this. Like, what happened to it? Why have we gone? Why did we go wrong kind of so soon and for so long? Yeah. And of course, it, you know, might not be an easy answer to that question. But I'd just be curious how you think through that. Yeah. Is this an entirely new thing? Did we lose it within, you know, the first couple of decades? And if so, does that give you any pause on it, and why maybe not?
Yep. So, I mean, I think I can answer that. Just maybe we should focus on Paul and Judaism, Paul and the law. Yeah. It's clear we already have some issues. I mean, Acts 21 is showing there are some issues of what Luke thinks are misreadings of Paul in the law. So whenever Acts is written, it's traditionally, well, in scholarship, it's generally viewed to be sort of 80s and 90s. More and more scholars, though they're still in a relatively small minority, are pushing Acts to around 120, 115, 120, which isn't really, at the end of the day, that big a difference when we're thinking about 2,000 years ago almost. But already, you know, within a couple generations of Paul, we can see that there are competing accounts of Paul. And I think one of the reasons we get that is because when you take Paul's very specific letters addressed to a specific audience, specific ethnic makeup, or at least a specific ethnic identity of a implied reader, and then all of a sudden say these are scripture and anybody and everybody should be reading them everywhere, then all of a sudden, you know, a very narrow message to one person or one group of people becomes a very broad message, which easily leads to it being misread or misapplied. Kind of like when, if I, you know, I'm trying to send a text to my wife and I actually sent it to a group of friends. They're not going to know what our conversation had been up to that point. And it could easily lead to misunderstanding, confusion, anger, all kinds of things, right? And I think that's part of what happens with Paul's letters. So that's sort of like the I think what naturally happens over time. But you add to it the fact that you have a group of believers in Jesus who are become increasingly, like in terms of demographics, they're increasingly non-Jewish. The initial movement is Jewish. It becomes more and more Gentile. And all of a sudden, it's almost entirely Gentile, mostly Gentile. And they're fighting over who actually are Abraham's heirs. Who's reading these Jewish scriptures correctly? And they're having these arguments, not just with each other, which is true, they are, but also with Jews, which we see a lot of dialogue and debate between Jews and Jesus believers or later Christians. And so as soon as you have those debates, you're looking for these texts for ammunition against Jews. And if you take Paul's letters and you universalize them, they become absolutely that. So I think it's partly just how reading's going to change when you have when you universalize, but it's also going to change because of the rhetorical needs of later generations who are trying to prove we are the true Israel, not you Jews who don't believe in Jesus.
Very helpful. Well, we'll wrap up with a little segment we do here on the show. We ask all the guests the same questions, called the Final Four. The first question is, what has been the most fruitful habit or spiritual discipline in your life?
that's a great question. I often semi-jokingly, mostly jokingly, refer to myself as religious, not spiritual. Mm-hmm. In some ways, pushing back against that I'm spiritual, not religious, stuff that I find really frustrating, and others do as well. So I kind of wanted to answer just that, but I also find walking, hiking outdoors in nature is, well, it's a spiritual practice where there's time to meditate, to self-reflect, to pray, to do whatever I feel like I need to do in those moments. And I find that being in nature sort of unlocks some of the spiritual side of a person who's not particularly spiritual. So that's that. I guess that's probably my answer.
I like it. I've been wanting to put a spiritual but very religious on a t-shirt for a while now, but yeah. It's been long enough that I haven't done it that someone can take that and run with it. Question number two, outside the Bible, what has been the most impactful book on your life?
Oh, that is a hard one. I guess it depends what one means by impactful and in what areas of life. But when I think of in terms of my mind and my own thinking, and then in my own writing, it's going to be an odd answer, and that's Jacob Milgram's Leviticus commentary. His three volume, very technical Leviticus commentary has changed my mind, my thinking, my theology in so many different ways. And made me rethink everything I know about Leviticus, ancient Judaism, the Gospels, even Paul. And so that's probably number two.
No one has answered that one yet, but I fully back it. I've got it on Lagos. Don't have them as, you know, bookshelf candy, but wonderful stuff. All right, question number three. You're having coffee with your undergrad or early grad school self. I know you've done plenty of school. What's one piece of advice you give him for his future in biblical studies?
I'm not alone here. People did this to me when I was thinking about doing a biblical studies PhD, and that was essentially don't unless you can't. And that's, a nod in this. So I was thinking about PhD studies in 1999, in biblical studies or at least theology or something along those lines. And the mentors, the academic mentors I had were essentially, it's so hard to get a job unless there's nothing else you could ever possibly imagine doing, go do a biblical studies degree. And it's not gotten better. It's gotten a lot worse. And that's a really depressing piece of advice to give people. I would say, in conjunction with that, however one defines vocation, that's actually another piece of advice I got when I was starting my PhD studies. However one defines vocation or meaning in life, if you're going to go do grad studies, in really anything but biblical studies, view it as, if you view it as a vocational thing, not just a career, or anything else, but a vocational, I'm making some meaning out of my life, or this is what I'm devoting my life to, that's going to serve you, I think, much better than anything else. And if you don't feel like it's vocational, you may find yourself having a very hard time to get through a PhD and to endure the various trials and tribulations that are academia.
Yeah, I've seen how many applications come in to fill a single slot in Bible and theology departments, and it's not an encouraging thing. So I think, if it's discouraging advice, I think it's good advice nonetheless. All right, the last question. The channel's called Gospel Simplicity. It's been called that for a long time, and people like to point out, a bit tongue-in-cheek, that none of the conversations are really all that simple. And so I do like to land the plane with, in a sentence or so, for you, what is the gospel?
Yeah, so you need to stop talking to academics, first of all, if you want more simplicity. Yeah. And again, I really hate the idea of one sentence answers. because I don't think the gospel is quite that reducible. But I would say, especially for Paul, since we've talked about Paul, and I think it's a great definition of the gospel, is that the Messiah has come, been killed, and Israel's God has raised him from the dead, and he's going to raise you too.
I love it. For someone that doesn't like one sentence answers, you're one of the few people that has actually answered that in a sentence. So
maybe with a semicolon or two in there, I did. I thought that was maybe two or three sentences.
Yeah. I'll give it to you. I think if I transcribed a lot of the answers, they would have about 12 semicolons in there. Dr. Thiessen, thank you so much for your time today. And thanks to all of you who watch this video sometime in the future. I don't take your time lightly. I'll close as I always do. I'm saying until next time, be on the lookout for more videos. But far more importantly than that, go out and love God and love others, because truly, above all else, that will change the world.